This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are some of the day's headlines from NPR News. The Federal Reserve has moved to lower interest rates today, shaving a quarter point off the rate down to 1 percentage point. NPR's Jim Zarroli is covering the Fed's effort to get the economy moving again, and there's growing evidence Al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorist groups continue to plan attacks. Some analysts believe the war in Iraq has strengthened Al-Qaeda, providing a new cause for militants to rally around. NPR's Mike Schuster will have more on that, and you can hear those reports later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. He was one of the great figures of history and had a genius for expression. Here is Britain's Winston Churchill addressing his country at a critical moment in history in 1940.
Behind us, behind the armies and fleets of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned races, the Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch, the Belgians, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless we conquer, as conquer we must, as conquer we shall.
Winston Churchill in his first address to the nation after he became Prime Minister in 1940. There is no dearth of material about Winston Churchill, but our next guest has chosen an unusual way to write about him. Joining us from our bureau in New York is Gretchen Rubin, author of 40 Ways to Look at Winston Churchill, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks so much for having me, Neil.
40 Ways?
40 Ways.
40 Ways. Why 40?
Well, 40 is a word that historically was used the way we use a million to mean just a lot, like 40 ways and 40 nights. So I used 40 to just stand for the idea that there was innumerable ways of looking at Winston Churchill.
Well, why break it up in all these different facets? That's very different from what other people have written.
Right. Well, with most biographies, they are comprehensive. They go from birth to death. And I decided that with Winston Churchill, there was just such an overwhelming amount of material, and there were already so many excellent long biographies that existed, that I wanted to tackle the challenge of writing a short biography and see if I could write an accessible biography that would really capture the essence of Churchill and also the ambiguities of his character and life, but have it be short and really distilled down to the very, very bare bones. And so that's why I had to choose a different format from most biographies.
Well, here are a few of your chapter headings. Churchill as Liberty's Champion, Churchill as Failed Statesman, Churchill's Genius with Words, Churchill the Drinker. Why did you structure the book like that?
Well, I wanted it to be like a dozen biographies rolled into one that would give you all the contrasting viewpoints that usually you can only get by reading several biographies. So I really asked myself, what are the essential questions that a person who knows nothing about Winston Churchill would want to know? I decided they would ask things like, what was his supreme moment? What was his greatest strength? What were his weaknesses? The first two chapters, the ones you referred to, the first one is the story of his life in a very positive way, and the second one is the negative story of his life. If somebody wanted to just absolutely cut him not one bit of slack and put the worst possible spin on everything, it's actually absolutely factually accurate, but it's just the very negative take. And so I think reading the two right next to each other gives a person a really different way of looking at Churchill. And they realize that when they read a biography, the facts are being manipulated. They have to be manipulated. But instead of hiding it, my biography really highlights that so that readers can form their own opinion about this truly tremendous character from history.
So in a way, what you're saying is that other biographies, and as you mentioned with Winston Churchill, there are more than a few, and many of them very good, but
yes,
that each of them, you know, comes at it with an idea. And in a sense, that yours doesn't. You shatter him into all of these different images so that we can choose for ourselves.
Exactly. And necessarily a biographer has to have a point of view, or else that you would just be reporting just an infinite number of facts. And that wouldn't be satisfying for a reader. It wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't be illuminating in any way. But at the same time, if you only read one biography, you don't realize the filter that you're looking at the character through. And so my book makes that very clear. And I think it's a quick way for readers to get a sense that they really are getting a very rounded picture of a character about whom there are many ambiguities, and there's many lots of points of discussion about, was he a success or a failure? Was he a military genius or a meddling amateur? Was he a great defender of liberty, or was he a reactionary imperialist? And so instead of trying to fuse it into the true answer, I really pull them apart. And I think it's a really interesting way for readers to think about Winston Churchill.
He lived such a long life and did so many different things and at times succeeded at them and at times failed miserably you can find all of these different things. I just want to talk about any biographer would have to address the issue of Churchill's ambition. You have a chapter called Churchill's Desire for Fame. And the first paragraph, Churchill was driven by his longing for fame. He lusted for honors, medals, offices, the respect of kings, a place in history. He worked constantly to thrust himself into the supreme role he believed he deserved. What an awful thing it will be if I don't come off, he fretted as a junior officer. It will break my heart, for I have nothing else but ambition to cling to. And that, at the same time, as a we tend to think often of ambition as an ignoble goal, nevertheless, it was an important part of what drove him and put him in position to achieve many great things.
Yes, and Churchill himself said that it's very rare for a man to be able to make more than one serious mistake, and he made many mistakes, and he was he was down so many times. I think that's part of why we like learning about him, is because he was a person who fought his way back so many times, and his ambition was very important in fueling that. You know, his devastating loss of the prime ministership in 1945, but he was back in 51. So ambition was very, very important in driving him forward.
One of your chapters, number 35, is called Churchill, True or False, in which you try to dispel some of the myths surrounding the man. And let me read a couple and you can tell us the answer. Churchill never attended university.
That's true.
Didn't he go to Sandhurst?
He did. That's a military academy, though. He didn't go to Cambridge or Oxford.
Ah, so he didn't go to one of the elite schools, but Sandhurst, the rough equivalent of West Point.
Exactly.
Now, he insisted that a champagne bottle be passed to the left around the table.
True. That was a superstition that he followed rigorously.
Churchill hated paperclips.
True. He refused to allow them to be used.
Why?
Just hated them. He had a lot of funny things. He hated whistling. He hated orange juice. And just didn't like paperclips.
When he returned in 1939 as First Lord of the Admiralty, a message was flashed out to all of the ships of the fleet, Winston is back.
Well, that's a very interesting one because that is false, but it's widely, widely believed to be true. But in 1994, Martin Gilbert, who is the most authoritative biographer of Churchill, said that he had scoured the record of that telegram and he could never find it. And I think if you just think about a telegram saying Winston is back, it sounds highly unlikely. So I think that story is apocryphal, even though most people do believe it is true.
Let me ask you, after all of this work and taking all of these different aspects of this remarkable character, did you come away with any one understanding of him?
Well, my second to last chapter is My Churchill, and I describe sort of my vision of Churchill. And I do. I really came out of it feeling that his flaws and his limitations and his vices were so overwhelmed by his greatness and his genius. I really am a total hero worshiper of Churchill, and that's the Churchill that I have in my mind. And he's just an inexhaustible subject, and I loved him more the more I learned about him, and I felt very fortunate about that. But there are other ways to see him, and it was interesting in the book to be able to flesh those out as well.
This may be getting back to the myths and realities, the true or false thing, but surely we can all live knowing that at least once he did retort famously, yes, but I'll be sober in the morning?
Yes. Well, I've heard different versions of it, but basically that's true. There's so many great Churchill stories, it can be hard to know exactly which ones happened which way, but that's one of the best lines.
Well, to set us up for it, if we're unfamiliar with the predecessor to that punchline.
Well, the story as I've heard it, you told a variation, was that he was speaking to Lady Astor, who was an American woman who was quite a character. She was also a member of Parliament in Britain. And she said, Winston, if I were your wife, I'd put poison in your coffee. And he said, but if I were your husband, I'd drink it.
Okay.
That's the version that I heard.
Gretchen Rubin, thank you very much for being with
us. Thank you so much for having me.
Gretchen Rubin is the author of 40 Ways to Look at Winston Churchill, and she joined us from our bureau in New York.